You're listening to the Accenture Insurance Influencers Podcast.
I think you take for granted when you're at big companies just how much of the heavy lifting the name on your business card does. And there's a machine that magically produces candidates for you to interview.
Hi, I'm Igrani Yu, and this is the Accenture Insurance Influencers Podcast. In this episode, I'm speaking with Jennifer Fitzgerald.
I'm the CEO and co-founder of Policy Genius.
Thanks for joining me today, Jennifer. I wanted to talk a bit about your background. You've been in the Peace Corps, you went to Columbia Law School, and you were a consultant at McKinsey, which is where you met your co-founder, Francois Delamme. How do all these experiences come to play in what you're doing today with Policy Genius?
I mean, I think everybody's got their own path to eventually starting a company. It was never something that was on the bucket list for me. I just kind of fell into the opportunity and had a lot of conviction about this idea. So that was my path. I think what it affords me as the CEO and co-founder is just a pretty rich set of life experiences to draw from, which allows me to connect the dots pretty effectively, which, you know, at this scale is my job as the CEO. You know, we've built a really good leadership team. We've got several hundred people who work here now. So I'm not in the fully in the weeds and having to do all of the work anymore. So my job is to be able to connect the dots and to bring, you know, both the insights and the wisdom to my team. It makes me sound like I'm very old. I'm not, but the varied life experience has been helpful, helpful for that. And it also just allows me to connect with a broader set of our customers. It allows me to think about, you know, how we frame ourselves to potential employees. And it's just been, you know, helpful as we've grown this company.
I feel like sometimes that's a challenging thing for an entrepreneur to do, especially if you have built a company up from the ground of five people. At what point did you realize, hey, I need to be stepping back, I need to install a leadership team, or even, you know, in some cases, people have a leadership team and then don't fully empower them. So can you speak almost personally, like what was that like for you to hand over this company and say, hey, guys, here you go. I'm going to do these other things now.
I didn't really have to convince myself to do it, because at some point, had I continued doing everything, I probably would have just dropped dead from exhaustion. So it was more just, one, a matter of practicality. And then two, if you get it right, you know, your job as a CEO is to hire people who are better than you in their respective functions, right? So who know technology, who know marketing, who know, you know, finance or org building. So what I found is that, and this is what I tell employees and the leadership team as well, every 6 months, especially in a growth stage company, your job is changing. So I just have to be conscious of the fact that my job evolves every few months, and to make sure that I have the leverage, we have the team in place to support, you know, my new job and this new stage of company. So it wasn't handing over things was not the hard part for me. What's the hard part, and it's universally the hard part, is getting the right people in place. That's incredibly hard to do.
So how do you find the right people?
You've got to like focus on it. I spend most of my time each week just actually in hiring. I'm either interviewing, or I'm meeting potential candidates, or you know, sourcing folks, or working with the leadership team and the people team to think about our hiring plan. So most of the time, I'm actually just thinking about recruiting and hiring. It's one of the most important things that I can do. We've learned a lot over the years about how to interview effectively, how to think about the candidate experience. So it's just been a lot of trial and error, and there's no shortcut. I meet with a group of CEOs of similar stage companies once a month. And, you know, basically every issue that we talk about is some variation of I need to get my leadership team aligned, or I've got gaps on my leadership team, or I don't know if I have the right leadership team. So everything at the end of the day, assuming that your idea is validated and your strategy is working, which is a big if, and a lot of companies die at that stage. Once you get beyond that, it really just comes down to people and making sure that you've got the right people in the right roles, and they're engaged and they're motivated and they're all running in the same direction.
when you are hiring someone who's better than you, and that implies that they know more than you, how do you objectively evaluate them in a meaningful way? Mm-hmm. Does that question make sense?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
How do you know what you're looking for if you don't know as much as them?
So you do a couple things. So one is you do, at least in the hiring phase, you've got folks who can speak to that, right? So if I have to hire, for example, the head of technology, I will involve folks outside of the company who can also vet them, right? Back channeling is an important source of that. So not just the references that a candidate gives you, but I go deep and I dig and I talk to people who reported to you, worked alongside you, who were your boss. I'll go a few companies back. So you develop a complete picture of who that person is and how they've operated in different environments. We have a pretty robust hiring process where there are people who are, who will potentially report to the person, who will be peers to the person, and then, of course, the person who will manage that person are all part of it. So we try to do a pretty robust 360-degree view of that person as a candidate. So I don't need to know how to be a software engineer to make sure that I am hiring a good leader of software engineers, for example, if I've structured the recruiting and interview process correctly.
Right. So it sounds to me like there's a pretty deliberate focus, not just on the skill set that you're looking for, but also on the culture and the cultural fit of the person. Can you tell me a bit about the culture at Policy Genius and what you've tried to build?
Yeah. Culture has been very important to us. One of our earliest employees and was a very seasoned head of people. And this sets us apart from other companies. Most companies don't hire a seasoned head of people until they're like, 100 plus employees. She was our 23rd employee, I believe. So that just signals how important we thought it was to focus on culture. Everybody says, the job of a startup is to build the product, right? So build the machine. And at some point you have to build the machine that builds the machine, which is around, the people, the processes, the systems in place. We wanted to take a proactive approach to that early on. So we've thought a lot about culture, and culture basically boils down to your values, which are the behaviors and the traits that you want to encourage employees, that you want to reward. They are the things by which you judge business decisions that don't have a clear black and white answer. So we thought a lot about values, and we thought a lot about how to operationalize values, which goes a long part to creating that culture.
I feel like values can be so helpful when they're done well. And sometimes when they're not, they become these sort of hollow things that people sort of throw around, like, oh, we're open and transparent and ambitious. But if they're not backed up by systems or by leadership or other factors, they sort of ring hollow. So can you talk a little bit about how you set the values and how you back those up and actually bring them to life?
Sure. So we've got our values, and any company can write their values on a piece of paper, to your point, right? And if you only do that, it's pretty hollow and inauthentic. We've also thought very deliberately about how to operationalize those, right? To make sure that they're part of the DNA and they're part of how we do business every day. So one of our values, for example, is no chuckleheads allowed. A lot of companies have a no jerks rule. I like the term chucklehead. It's inclusive of jerks. And so how do we operationalize that? Well, one big piece is we've got the values alignment interview. So we typically have a couple people in every single interview process who test for values alignment. And we actually have specific questions around that. And we have actually turned down candidates who were otherwise, very strong, great background, great resume, great skills, but weren't aligned with our values, or, there was a concern they would be a chucklehead and disruptive to the team. So that's one way we operationalize that value. One of our other values is you got to know how to work the problem. So being an efficient and effective problem solver is a behavior and a value that we prioritize at the company. And so one way we operationalize that is I, for example, lead the company, the entire company, through problem-solving training every quarter. My co-founder and I developed a condensed version of the problem-solving training that you get as a brand new McKinsey consultant into a training module that we run the company through. And anybody can sign up for it. You can re-up for it. So that's one way we've operationalized that value. And we've got a whole bunch of different examples to that, but we totally agree with you that you got to put your money where your mouth is when it comes to values, or else it's just, you know, hollow words on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, as you've scaled this company, as you've operationalized these values, what has been most surprising about the process to you?
What's been most surprising about the process is, I think, the company takes on a life of its own beyond me. So there are, you know, we have about 215 employees now. So we can't all fit in the same room. And it used to be, you know, me and a handful of us working in a tiny room, and everybody knew each other and everybody knew what was going on. And you know, there was that environment. And now, you know, across the 200 employees, you know, there's thousands and thousands of individual, like, one-on-one relationships, right? And it's been fascinating, surprising for me to see the company take on a life of its own, that there are people who are friends outside of work, and there are inside jokes that I'm not a part of because the company's at a scale that I can't know every inside joke now, right? So I think that's been the most surprising thing, is just things take on a life of its own and things start to move on their own without me having to kind of push that boulder, which is exactly what it was in the early days. So that's been both surprising and super rewarding to see.
And sort of the flip side of it, what have been some of your biggest challenges in scaling, whether it's culture or product or otherwise, and how have you addressed that challenge?
Yeah, I think our biggest challenge over the years, again, going back to talent, that's it. So I think we've been very focused on strategy and building the right product, and sure, there have been a couple hiccups along the way, but by and large, our strategy, our vision has not changed since day zero. So, you know, the hard things have been around, you know, people, right? And how do you acquire really great talent when, especially in the early days, you don't have a brand name? I think you take for granted when you're at big companies just how much of the heavy lifting the name on your business card does. And there is a machine that magically produces candidates for you to interview. And when you are building a company from scratch, that is absolutely not the case. You've got to convince an employee who has or a prospective employee who has, you know, several, if not dozens of options out there, why your company that they've never heard of before is the place that they should invest this next stage of their career. It's gotten easier now that we've gotten bigger and we're a more recognized brand in the tech scene in New York City. But it's still, you know, hard because I'm competing with Google and Facebook and Amazon and you name the company for talent. So that's the evergreen hard thing about doing a business.
And I'm just curious, what are the distinctive things? Why would somebody choose a policy to work at Policy Genius versus Amazon or Google?
Impact. The big thing is, you know, when you're at those companies, you are one of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, employees. And, you know, at those companies, you can work really hard, but, you know, are you actually going to feel like the impact that you're making is distinctive? I think most people at some point feel like I could not show up tomorrow and nobody would notice. Whereas if you are at a company at our stage, it is very much felt, right? Like there's not a lot of fat in the system. We run very lean. You have the ability to make a decision today and implement it the same day. Versus if you're at a Google or an Amazon or a Facebook, there's going to be levels and levels and layers of bureaucracy and decision-making and stakeholder management that you have to go through. And so it's a different thing, right? It's also probably an easier lifestyle there versus, you know, here there's going to be more ambiguity. Things change a lot more quickly. So it just really depends on what stage you're at and what you're looking for out of your career. But, you know, if you don't want to be the cog in the wheel at a big institution, you know, this is a pretty compelling value prop for that person.
And what impact do you see Policy Genius having on the industry or the world?
So we are, you know, really transforming and changing the game in insurance. I think when we launched a few years ago, InsurTech wasn't a thing. There wasn't an InsurTech conference. We were one of the pioneers in InsurTech, and we've created this wave of fast followers who are focused on life insurance and just InsurTech more broadly. So I think we've sort of opened up the tech opportunity in insurance. And we are helping, you know, millions of customers every year, which is hugely important for me as the CEO and is very motivating for the employees here at Policy Genius.
I'm curious, because you have sort of become this industry leader in InsurTech, particularly in the life insurance space, what decision points do you think have been most influential to getting you to that point?
I think one is the decision point around timing and just doing it. I think you can always talk yourself away from the cliff of doing something high risk. And so just doing it and doing it when we did it was a really great decision, because so much of business is around timing. And you can have a great idea, but if the timing's off in the market, then it doesn't matter. So I think our timing was great to start the business when we did. And then two, I think some of the early on decisions strategically we made about what to focus on versus what not to focus on. So for example, not to go down the well-trodden path of auto insurance, focus on life insurance when that started to take off, to build all of the software and operations in-house was a big strategic decision that not a lot of other companies have made, has created a huge competitive advantage for us now and allows us to move faster, build more quickly. So I think a lot of the earliest hard decisions, the other one, sorry, before I go on, was content. So early on, we saw an opportunity to focus on creating high quality content that would not only provide great advice and decision support for users, but also allow us to open up Google organic search as a channel for us. It's a long game. It's something that takes years to invest in before you start seeing results, but we did it and we kept at it. And now it's a huge moat between us and our competitors.
So before Policy Genius, neither you nor your co-founder, Francois Delam, had started a company before. What do you know now that you wish you knew then?
Everything. Like probably literally everything, which is why you see so many second and third time founders. Because we were just remarking about this the other day, like, oh God, we've learned so much. And there's so many things that if we were to do a second company at some point in the distant future, we would do these things differently. So I think that's why you see a lot of repeat founders. But, you know, at the same time, there's just a lot of things that you can't know until you experience it. Like some of it's just around gut feeling, right? So people can ask me, when do you know that something's working or not? And you can talk about leading indicators and lagging indicators and things like, you know, conversion and adoption, but sometimes and more often than not, it just feels like it's working. Everything's clicking. Every incremental thing gets incrementally easier. So a lot of times it's just kind of the gut feeling of everything coming together, or conversely, everything just kind of grinding to a halt or feeling like it's harder than it should be. So I don't know that, but for going through this, I could have told myself, you know, 5-6 years ago, hey, here are the things that you should do. Other than the fact, like, focus on getting the people right, because that is a no regrets move in any situation.
Where do you go for help? Like, if you're stuck on something, you've mentioned that you have this network of founders of similar sized companies. Do you have mentors, other groups? Are you a book reader? Like, where are you going to get that insight that you need to make a decision more clear?
Yep, I am a book reader and newsletter reader, and just generally just reading everything I can online about you know, building, scaling a company. The most important thing, I think, is to have a network of peers who've also seen the movie that you're in, or at least is a little bit further along, just to bounce ideas off of, or even just sanity check how you're approaching things. So having a peer network is helpful. I don't have a mentor per se. And one panel I was on a couple years ago, this woman who's the founder and CEO of an HR tech company, she had a great metaphor, which I quite liked, which is, you know, designating somebody a mentor is like pretty stressful because that's putting a lot on the shoulders of one person. Instead, what you should have is kind of like your advisory board, right? Like you've got somebody that you go to for X, you've got somebody who you can bounce off of Y. And for me, that's just been a much more helpful construct. So I've got, you know, a big network of people that I can ping, whether it's a super tactical question about, hey, how do I think about X thing? Versus somebody I can like go out to dinner or grab a coffee with and have a more in-depth conversation. So that for me has been absolutely key.
Just on a personal note, I noticed that you are a storyteller. So you told a story on The Moth and you used to do stand-up comedy. Do you feel like that brings another lens to the sort of insurance story and particularly the content side of things?
Oh, totally. And, you know, the storytelling and the creative side has been important for, you know, our early days of marketing content strategy. But, you know, even more tactically as a CEO, a lot of what I have to do on a regular basis is, you know, frame a compelling story for people, whether it's prospective candidates, whether it's for investors, whether it's, you know, getting everybody excited about, at all hands about this new product that we're launching. So much of what I have to do is be an effective storyteller to whatever audience I'm speaking to. So that's been a really, really useful skill for me.
Well, I've really enjoyed hearing your stories today, and I hope some of them resonate with our listeners. Thanks for making the time to speak with me today.
Thanks for having me on.
That wraps up my conversation with Jennifer Fitzgerald from Policy Genius. It also wraps the second season of this podcast. We're already working on season 3 with a focus on how incumbents and insurtechs are reimagining insurance. And we'll also take a look at the state of leadership in the insurance industry. Watch for those episodes in a few weeks. Until then, I'm Igrani Yu, and this has been the Accenture Insurance Influencers Podcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Accenture Insurance Influencers Podcast. To hear more great episodes, visit Accenture.com/insurance influencers.